The Cold War, it produced antagonisms, competing historical narratives that today, these years after the event, continue to be difficult to disrupt and perhaps accurately interpret. Cold War also produced some fascinating architectural projects, some surprising collaborations. Lukasz Stanek is an architectural historian, and he's the author of Architecture in Global Socialism, Eastern Europe, West Africa, and the Middle East in the Cold War. And it's a book that follows architects and planners from socialist Europe who worked in these places at that time and the extraordinary things that they created, not all of them, of course, being simply buildings. Lukasz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is something of a corrective, a revision of that Cold War discourse.
That's right. Until now, architectural historians very much thought about the worldwide emergence of architecture, the emergence of architecture as a global phenomenon after World War II, pretty much as a process of westernization. And this book shows that these processes were much more complex, and it stresses the active role of the collaboration or between actors, including architects and planners and construction companies from socialist countries and their counterparts in the decolonizing world.
Can we start on that socialist country part of that equation? Who are we talking about? What sort of people and from what countries and in what period?
Right. So I'm talking about activities between the 1950s and the 1980s. And I'm focusing in particular on socialist countries in Europe, that is to say, from East Germany to the Soviet Union, from Poland to Romania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia. There were, of course, many other socialist countries outside Europe, most importantly China, which too had an active role as, if you like, an architectural exporter. But I focus on Eastern European socialist countries.
And you focus, too, on a collection of countries in which this architecture was practiced, which are described as non-aligned, which is an interesting distinction in that period.
That's right. So my intention, in a way, the main idea of the book was not to focus on what could be called Soviet satellites or countries which were close allies or which were very much dependent on the Soviet Union, such as, for example, Mongolia or Vietnam or even Cuba. Rather, I was looking at countries which emerged from the colonial period and which very much try to negotiate their place in the world across those various alliances and Cold War antagonists. And so the countries I focus on in the book are Ghana and Nigeria, as well as Iraq and two countries in the Gulf, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait. So in the periods I write about, only Ghana was socialist, if you like, a country which tried to embark on the socialist development path under its leader Kwame Nkrumah. The other countries were in no way socialist countries in the sense of how socialism was envisaged in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. Iraq did develop towards a special type of socialism under the Ba'ath Party. But it very much distinguished its policies, both internal and foreign, from the Soviet Union. Nigeria was very much hostile towards socialism, let alone the monarchies of the Gulf.
This is where the interesting sort of counter-narrative begins, because we have here countries emerging in a post-colonial period, attempting to align themselves in some way with the movement of modernism, and this can as coherently be done with the the block that brought us Sputnik as it can be done with global capitalism. But it's not an interpretation that's normally put on the modernist movement in the global south.
That's right. So my book begins really with the period of Khrushchev, that is to say the period when the Soviet Union again embraced modernism with programs of large-scale prefabrication, construction of housing neighborhoods for the masses, and so on, which doesn't mean that architecture was mobilized from the socialist period, from the socialist countries before. For example, there were major buildings which were designed by Soviet architects in China in the 1940s during the Stalinist period. However, the period I look at specifically begins with Khrushchev, hence with the post-war version of modernism in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe.
What sort of buildings are we talking about? When we imagine socialist architecture, we imagine that sort of brutalist monumentalism, but there are many, many different expressions in the places that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So we are talking about really all sorts of buildings. We are talking about monumental ensembles, about large-scale structures which were supposed to convey that sense of a new statehood, of a new national identity of countries such as Ghana or Nigeria, for instance. But we are also talking about, you know, a vast series of housing neighborhoods, about type buildings which provided social infrastructure, schools or buildings for education and health and culture. Of course, a lot of the activities of architects and construction companies from Eastern Europe in the Global South were focused on industrial facilities, including the type of industry which interests me most, which is the construction materials industries. For example, you know, prefab factories or steel factories or cement factories. But I have also a broad understanding of architecture, which is not reduced to buildings, but also includes things like urban standards and building norms or regulations or master plans. So large-scale plans for cities, which define how cities should be developed, you know, in the course of decades. I'm also talking about curricula for architectural schools, which were emerging in the Global South, and research ideas. And so this is a really broad understanding of architecture and architectural culture, which is not reduced to building.
Is there a proximity between these cities of the Global South and the satellite states of the Eastern Bloc?
What motivated me really to select the specific countries and cities I chose rather than others was that by looking at Accra and Lagos and Baghdad and Abu Dhabi and Kuwait City, I could tell very, very different stories. So some of the cities and countries in which the cities are located were eager to develop socialism, probably, you know, very specific socialism adapted to the local conditions, and that was the case in Accra. But other places, for instance, Nigeria, were certainly not interested in developing socialism. And so the motivation to invite Eastern European architects and companies was very, very different. Mm. For instance, Nigerians were eager to offset the dominance of Western companies and to stimulate competition on the construction market. And that also meant that when architects from Eastern Europe, from Germany or from Poland or from Yugoslavia or from Hungary arrived to Lagos, they did not arrive in the name of socialism, and hence they had to find other ways in which, you know, they could not simply substitute the presence in Nigeria, but also find tools to address the challenges in Nigeria. And that opened up, you know, all sorts of speculation, sometimes experimental speculation, about what are the words which Eastern Europeans and Nigerians share. And, for example, I'm looking at longer traditions of Eastern European architectural culture, which address questions of underdevelopment or national identity. So very much concerns which Nigerians and Poles and Hungarians and Bulgarians share.
There's a wonderful quote which you open your book from a Ghanaian architect who says this: "I remember well these Eastern European architects because it was the first and last time that a white man had an African boss in Ghana." What does that tell you about the nature of this encounter?
So this is really a wonderful quote, which is which comes with a lot of meaning. It shows, to begin with, you know, how special, how extraordinary this moment of independence was. Ghana became independent from Britain in 1957. And after so much time passed, this architect remembers this period with such a, you know, with such a sharp clarity. But it also meant for me that architecture needs to be looked in terms of relationships of collaboration, relationships of labor, architecture as a, you know, way of people to work together, right? Because what he focuses on in this quote is, you know, not buildings or beautiful forms or images. He's really thinking about how people collaborated and how, in the wake of independence, in the wake of decolonization, were labor relationships in a design institute changed.
Go to another example, and Baghdad is one of the cities in which you focus. The difference between the socialist and British plans for Baghdad.
Right. So when the dependence on the West was interrupted by the coup of Qasim in Iraq until then very much related institutionally and professionally to Britain and to the West more generally, started to develop links with Eastern Europe, with the Soviet Union. And this is in that context that Polish planners were invited, after winning a tender competition, to design the master plan of Baghdad. And what was very, very striking to me when I studied this master plan is the contrast between simply the sizes of that documentation. A master plan is a legal document, and the previous master plan, which had been delivered by British planners. So the British master plan is 23 pages long. The master plan delivered by the Polish planners is four volumes in size, has four volumes in size. And so, you know, I was very curious, what was the reason yes. for that big shift, which, you know, there was not more than 10 years between those two master plans, so it couldn't have been, you know, a major shift in planning culture or something like that. In a way, this curious contrast led me to look at the ways, for example, in which these master plans were presented. So while the British present, you know, very much kind of authoritative decisions, the Poles were proposing scenarios. They were evaluating data, very uncertain data, very fragmented data, very unreliable data, which was there in Baghdad. And so they, you know, they were much more in the business of convincing the Iraqis, presenting the Iraqi decision makers with possibilities from which these decision makers chose the scenario they wanted. And so it is, it relates to what I mentioned before. The way of working changed. It is no longer, you know, a top-down decision. It is no longer the decision where the planners simply propose one solution, but rather the Eastern European planners and architects were what I want to call weak actors who were not so much decision makers, but who were people who proposed solution, and then the decision makers, the administrators, the government in the former colonial countries decided. That was a complicated dynamics, because for instance, most of these decision makers were educated in the West. They were socialized within Western planning culture, and so quite often they were quite suspicious towards those newcomers, towards planning cultures which they were not very acquainted with. And so that moment of persuasion, that moment of evidence became very, very important.
There's a very human element to that, and I guess we see there, and this is in very broad terms, a distinction between planning and architecture which serves capital and planning and architecture which serves a social objective.
Yes, I think that that, again, has something to do with various cultures, architectural cultures in Europe. You know, planning is this very curious word which is very difficult to translate from one European language to other. You know, in England, we speak about urban design or civic design. In France, we talk about urbanisme. In Germany, we speak about Städtebau. And these terms are really not, they are really not good translations, because they differ in scales, they differ in sort of associations, which have been developed in the course of you know, the last 100 years. For example, that working across scales, that conviction that one can, that architecture somehow seamlessly can be developed into an urban scale, that is, I would argue, more of a feature of the Central European understanding of planning, in difference, for example, to the French urbanisme.
Lucas, thank you so much for such a nuanced reappraisal. It's opens a world of possibilities, and we appreciate your time walking us through.
Thank you so much.
Lucas Stanek, architectural historian, and his book, Architecture in Global Socialism, Eastern Europe, West Africa, the Middle East in the Cold War. And this is Blueprint on Radio National.